The 100 Years' War. That great big pivotal fight between England and France. It actually lasted more than 100 years. But here we are in 1420, and it has lasted 83 years. And it is now about to step up and get even more intense. And because of that, we now need to do a special episode where we just look at what the hell was happening in that war between France and England. Because it was really, really complicated. And it's also really, really important. In order to understand London's story over the next few years, we need to look at the war in France and what Henry V was doing that was so different than from what any other English king had ever done before. Hi there, my name is Saul and you are listening to The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the chronological history of the city of London as it meanders through the streets of time. We've reached about the year 1419 and 1420, and it's time just to take a step back. I spent all of last episode focusing specifically on life in the streets of the city, but this one we need to take an overview of what's happening across the English Channel. Because, well, as you'll see in the upcoming episodes, what was happening over these next few years is going to change the story of London completely. And so, without further ado, welcome to chapter 152 of the story, 83 years and counting. So, despite it sounding really simple, the war between England and France was actually a complicated thing. And right now, Henry V was part of making it more complicated. Because Henry V's version of the war was very different from any previous king's. Before 1419, Henry V of England had roughly held the same political objectives as all the kings since Edward III, his great-grandfather, had followed. Which meant that although he claimed that the crown of France belonged to him by hereditary right, he was also willing, in the name of peace, to compromise and accept sovereign rule over about, a third, maybe even a half of the kingdom, with the rest of it, and the title of King of France, going to, well, the French opponent, who at the time was the Valois King Charles VI. And believe it or not, for all the ups and downs in this war so far, that endgame position where England could own between a third and a half of the country was still on the table. 8 decades after Edward III had started this bloody war, that scenario was still viable. Why? Well, we have to understand, even if England had at best one-third of the population and correspondingly one-third of the wealth of the Kingdom of France, the two nations were fairly well matched in military strength. And how can I justify that statement? Well, let's look at the harsh truth. Between 1337 and 1419, neither side had been able to end the conflict and gain a decisive victory. See, the French always had an advantage in their number of soldiers, although the disparity was maybe not as big as the population suggested it should be. Yet while the French always had the numbers, partly it was the English royal government was way more efficient than the French one, especially when it came to things like the bureaucracy of the state and also how well it used Parliament. And this became a very powerful mechanism for gaining national consensus behind the war effort. All of which meant that, bottom line, England as a state provided the kings of this nation with a substantial edge in the mobilisation of their resources. The disadvantage of this, however, was that ultimately this cost the English state a fortune. Several fortunes. And this was depressing the overall economy. Still, the baseline superiority in the organisation and quality of English troops often meant they offset, sometimes very dramatically, the French advantage in numbers of troops. That superiority had enabled the English to win every full-scale battle of this war so far, including 3 keynote victories, Crécy in 1346, Poitiers in 1356, and recently Agincourt in 1415. And as well as those big banner battles, they'd also won most of the lesser battles as well. But it wasn't just about the organisation of the state that made English armies so damn good. There were 3 major reasons for this. First of all, the English archers, whose extraordinarily powerful longbows could drive a 4-ounce arrow with enough velocity and kinetic energy to accurately pierce armour at about 200 plus yards, were by far the best infantry of their day. Now, they were not supermen, and we know that they were not utilising Gatling guns. I mean, this medieval armour could and did deflect some longbow shots, and whatever the case, it often did limit the impact of the blows. So medieval armour wasn't entirely useless in the face of longbows. But regardless, the rate of fire, the sheer number of bolts, the longbowmen of the English state were rightfully feared. And secondly, added to this, the whole English army, from foot archers to army commanders, was deeply imbued with what the later German military theorist Klaus von Clausewitz called, quote, the military spirit, unquote. There was a unity of purpose and a commitment to the war the English had that the French simply did not have. And finally, over most of the periods of the war, the top English commanders demonstrated simply far greater tactical and strategic competence than their French enemies. The French did have very good military leaders, but not as many and not enough. And yet, the problem for both sides was to do with the nature of how this war was being fought. See, for the most part, this war was not being decided by battles. It was being decided by sieges. And indeed, it's this reliance upon siege warfare that meant, paradoxically for the English, that even when they enjoyed this big advantage in political and military leadership and had better quality troops and a better organized state, they simply did not have the manpower to conquer all of France or even significant parts of France or even to hold any major gains that they made. And this all meant that ultimately this was a war where neither side could deliver the knockout blow. And thus it was reduced to a form of stalemate, an endless cycle of attack and defence, a miasma of a never-ending conflict which had lasted for 83 years and change so far. There were times when political leaders on both sides actually appreciated this truth, and at those times both sides did work hard to try to resolve this war through, you know, diplomacy and negotiations. However, all attempts consistently failed, mostly due to the fact that the basic minimum terms each side will accept were fundamentally incompatible. The bottom line fundamental issue of this war was not how much land within France the English should be in control of. On this, there'd always been willingness to compromise. What really was the question is whether the English territories in France should be sovereign possessions of the kings of England, or if they should remain legally and politically subordinate and belonging to the Crown of France. Now, the political discourses of the earlier era of the war, the entire earlier medieval period, had been kind of able to accommodate divided jurisdiction and shared sovereignty over regions relatively comfortably. I mean, this was why this didn't make a crisis for William of Normandy or Henry I. Rather, it was an issue, as you may remember we covered back in chapter 59. but it wasn't some kind of existential crisis. But over the 13th and early 14th century, brought about by a revival of Roman law, a new conception of sovereignty had been developed, and that insisted upon the absolute and ultimately inalienable power of the state. There was therefore no middle ground on which the English or the French could construct a durable peace. The lands were either going to be French or English. Added to this, as time went by, diplomatic solutions became increasingly difficult due to the legacy of the royal families involved. Take, for example, the kings of England. As heirs of Edward III, the king who claimed to be rightful king of France could not accept anything less than sovereignty over part of France. And if they did, they would, by implication, dishonour their illustrious ancestors and all the kings since. I mean, backing down on claiming a part of France would be admitting that the English had for generations waged an unjust and futile war. It would be saying that the loss of so many lives, a waste of so much treasure, the devastation of so much land had never been worth it. No English king, especially not Henry V, could do this. And meanwhile, across the ornate negotiating table, no king of France would surrender their claim to sovereignty of any part of France without the same also being true. Neither side could back away without significant military defeat to incentivize them to do so. And all this meant was that for 83 years, England and France had been locked in a war seemingly without end. But this changed in the early 15th century. And the cause of this change was the ongoing mental instability of King Charles VI. The French king was known during the early part of his reign as Charles the Beloved, but he's ended up being recorded by history as Charles the Mad. What was the nature of his madness? We don't know for sure. Current theories range from him having full-blown schizophrenia to suffering from manic depressive psychosis. And some have even suggested that after a case of typhoid, his brain swelled and he suffered permanent brain damage. Whatever the case, he was a broken man with absolute power. And the French state had been designed so this man with absolute power was the engine needed to make the state actually run. And as the king veered in and out of psychosis, such a situation would inevitably lead to factions arising of different nobles seeking to steady the ship and take control behind the scenes. And because of this, eventually, two major political parties arose in France. The first of these was led in order by the king's brother, the Duc d'Orléans, and then that duke's son, and then after that, the faction was led by the Constable of France, Bernard de Armagnac, and this faction is mostly named after him by historians. It's called the Armagnacs, and after him, it was led by the Dauphin of France, the future Charles VII. Meanwhile, the rival faction was originally led by Charles VI's cousin, John the Fearless, the Duke of Burgundy, and then by John's widow, Margaret of Bavaria, and finally his son and successor, Duke Philip the Good of Burgundy. These were the Burgundian faction. The Burgundians and the Armagnac, the two powerful factions in French politics, and this was the split in France that Henry V was walking into. The Dukes of Burgundy were direct rulers of two large, wealthy, and territorially compact blocks of land. One southeast of Paris comprised of the Duchy of Burgundy and the counties around it, and the other block, northeast of the capital, included Flanders and Artois, which were some of the most urbanized and wealthiest areas of France outside of Paris. In addition, the rather rich and populous imperial duchies of Brabant and Namur and the counties of Hainaut, Holland and Zeeland were bound firmly to Burgundy throughout this period and eventually acquired by Philip himself. The whole area between these two blocks was throughout the period an area in which the Duke of Burgundy had massive influence as well, and he also had many supporters in Paris and the surrounding towns. Meanwhile, until 1417, the Orleanist or Armagnac faction mostly controlled all of France west and south west of Paris, with the exception of the English Duchy of Aquitaine, which was centred on Bordeaux, and Brittany, who were just kind of doing their own thing. England had always taken advantage of French division and weaknesses, but this civil war between the Armagnacs and the Burgundians was different. The two rival groups were of such equal power that what should have just been a two-way war between the English and the French now became a three-way war between the English, the Armagnac, and the Burgundian forces. And not only had the nature of the war changed, so had the stakes. As late as the spring of 1419, the main question was, first, what portion of France, if any, would be detached from the kingdom and transferred de jure to English control? But now, we added which French faction would dominate the remainder of the kingdom. The continued Armagnac-Burgundian fighting therefore allowed Henry, after the Battle of Agincourt, about 18 months in which to plan and organise a major expedition to exploit his great victory. It's a mark of King Henry's new status that after the Battle of Agincourt, Sigismund, formerly the King of Hungary and Emperor-elect of the Holy Roman Empire, not actual Holy Roman Emperor as I described in the last episode, did actually ask to visit him in England. Now, Sigismund actually came to England to talk to the king about two separate subjects. The first was a rather awkward schism taking place in the Roman Catholic Church, because right now there were three popes. You had Benedict XII in Avignon, Gregory VII in Rome, and John XXIII in Pisa. But as well as this really difficult problem he wanted to solve, Sigismund also wanted to resolve the fight between England and France. We know he arrived in Calais in 1416, and Henry made it a huge state visit, and we covered this last episode about its impact in London. And amid all those lavish entertainments across the Channel, the fundamental purpose of his visit was so that discussions should take place between him, Henry V, and French envoys who joined them in peace negotiations. But as they were happening, the heir to the French throne, the Dauphin, Louis, died, and he was succeeded to the post by his younger brother, John. John, after the Battle of Agincourt, had been given the title of Constable of France, the last constable having been killed in that battle. And now, having become the Dauphin, he felt he needed to fluff up his military popularity by taking from England its most recent conquest, Harfleur. Dauphin John raised an army and began to besiege the town, and then hired a fleet of Genoese galley ships to blockade the harbour. When news reached Henry V, who was involved in peace talks, he hit the bloody roof, and the king's first instinct was to personally lead an army to go to Harfleur and beat the crap out of this kid. But Sigismund managed to persuade him to stick around for a bit, and so Henry sent his brother John, the Duke of Bedford, instead. Bedford mustered at Rye whatever ships he could gather and arrived off Harfleur on the 14th of August to find that he was seriously outnumbered by enemy ships. The French fleet was up for a fight and went to meet him the next day, leaving the Genoese galleys in their secure moorings. And as we mentioned last episode, the Duke of Bedford managed to defeat this French fleet, and then he went on to attack the galleys, and he boarded many of them. And at the exact same time, the garrison in Harfleur decided to break out and attack the Dauphin's besieging army, who at this point went sod that and began to flee. By the end of the day, all the French and Genoese ships had either been destroyed, captured, or had sailed over the horizon, and the French army had withdrawn. Duke of Bedford landed in Harfleur, and once he was satisfied that it was sufficiently well defended, returned to England with his fleet. Not only had Dauphin John's expedition been an utter failure because he mounted it during the peace negotiations, it made him look entirely unchivalrous. However, with that going on, it's no surprise that the talks in England failed to come up with any kind of solution to this, or, you know, the embarrassing number of popes. Henry accompanied Sigismund as far as Calais and waved goodbye as he marched off back to the Holy Roman Empire, and then he himself returned to England to prepare now to invade France again. The preparations included the use of secret agents to gather intelligence on the continent's shifting political alliances and the strength and vulnerability of the forces and fortresses that he would have to overcome in France. Responsibility for a significant part of this intelligence gathering was given to the captain of Calais, who at that time was the Earl of Warwick, and he was provided with £100 just for this purpose. From now on, Calais would continue to be used for intelligence gathering in the surrounding regions, and it became standard for the captains to receive an annual £100 grant for a secret intelligence fund. And I mention this because going forward, the secret service of the English state was to begin to have rather an insidious effect upon the story of the capital. And when we come up to those moments, I'm just adding this note here so we remember it begins now in the reign of Henry V and secret payments to the captain of Calais. Meanwhile, Dauphin John decided that he was mostly allied to the Armagnac faction. And that's how, you know, he was fighting the English. But he didn't think they were up for it anymore. So he decided to end his alliance with them and came to an agreement with the Duke of Burgundy. They all agreed that the Dauphin would ally with Burgundy to overcome the Armagnacs, and Burgundy would now support the Dauphin in driving the English out of France. The Armagnacs were furious about this new coalition and summoned the Dauphin to Paris in the name of the king. The Dauphin replied that he would go to Paris only if it was accepted. He could bring the Duke of Burgundy and his followers with him. Because of this, the visit didn't happen. The situation was resolved, however, when the Dauphin John died in agony in April 1417, exhibiting rather suspiciously the symptoms of poisoning. And because of this, the 16-year-old Charles, his younger brother, became the new Dauphin. Charles was the opposite of his brother. His brother had turned to the Burgundians, but Charles was very much still allied to the Armagnacs. And as well as this, Charles totally disliked his mother and had her arrested and placed in jail, basically, in the town of Tours. And at the same time, the Count of Armagnac seized all her property. The queen was furious and wanted revenge on her son and on Armagnac. She managed to escape from Tours on the pretext of attending mass on the outskirts of town. And then she did the unthinkable. She joined forces with her oldest and most detested enemy, the Duke of Burgundy, who had assassinated her beloved in-law, the Duke d'Orléans. Burgundy and his men had been party to the plan to rescue her from her guards. And once safe, the Queen proclaimed herself Regent of France for the remaining period of King Charles's illness and appointed the Duke of Burgundy as her lieutenant. And this was the chaotic situation in France when Henry landed at Harfleur in August 1417. He was accompanied by 16,000 men-at-arms, the same number of archers, and a long train of artillery and siege engines, which had to be transported to Normandy on a fleet of 1,500 ships. This was a well-planned and determined invasion. While Henry was landing at Harfleur, the Duke of Burgundy and the Queen led an army to march on Armagnac-held Paris. The King and the Dauphin were both in the city, as was their court, but the Queen established her own royal court on the grounds that the King was being held prisoner by the traitorous Armagnacs. During the advance to Paris, more and more of the aristocracy joined them, and in May, they captured the city. And then a few days later, the Paris mob rose up and murdered about 2,500 Armagnac supporters, including the Count of Armagnac himself. The new Dauphin managed to escape with some followers, but the Duke of Burgundy and the Queen were able to take control of the king and the seat of government. And meanwhile, While this was going on, Henry V had been besieging towns in Normandy and had captured Caen, Bayeux and Falaise before moving into his winter quarters. The new campaign season of 1418 began with Henry receiving thousands of reinforcements from England and began to besiege Rouen in that July. Rouen was one of the major cities in France with a strong garrison that had received reinforcements of over 4,000 men. The town walls were well fortified with 60 towers and 6 gates, each protected by a barbican. Henry's siege of Rouen was actually very similar to the siege of Calais by his great-grandfather Edward III. Like Calais, it lasted quite some time and caused appalling suffering to the residents. The food shortage became so severe that the governor of Rouen decided to expel 12,000, quote, useless mouths, unquote. In other words, those who could not fight, the elderly, women and children. As with the previous siege of Calais, the English king would not allow these useless mouths pass through his lines, so they had to settle in the ditch outside of the city walls, and the majority of them, I'm afraid to say, starved to death. It was not until January of the next year, 1419, after 30,000 of the population had died from disease or starvation, that Rouen finally surrendered. Rouen was under English control. For the first time since King John, back in chapter 81, the capital of Normandy had a King of England in charge of it. Once Rouen had been occupied, finally, it became Henry's principal base for the remainder of his campaign. Understand, Calais remained a vital commercial centre and a source of crown revenue. That's where the wool staple was. Harfleur had become Henry's principal bridgehead into France, and Rouen now became his headquarters. Having established a firm base there, he soon captured the remainder of Normandy and began to march on Paris. After escaping from Paris, the Dauphin Charles had gathered together numerous members of the Armagnac, and in July he'd held preliminary peace meeting with the Duke of Burgundy. He'd actually arranged for a further meeting in September on a bridge in Montereau. But when that meeting happened, Duke John of Burgundy arrived on the appointed day, and he was murdered by the Dauphin's men, which basically guaranteed the Burgundian and Armagnac war would continue come what may. Duke John of Burgundy was succeeded by his 23-year-old son Philip, who, as you can imagine, wanted vengeance against the Dauphin and decided to make an alliance with King Henry because of this. I mean, understand, prior to this, Burgundy had been mostly neutral in the war between Henry and the French crown. But the murder of Duke John the Fearless meant that his son and successor jumped into bed with the English. And since Philip's faction controlled Paris and the Mad King Charles VI, he could offer a great deal in exchange for English help in gaining vengeance for his father's murder. The result of this was the Treaty of Troyes of 1420, by which King Charles VI of France and his queen disinherited their only surviving son, the Dauphin, and then arranged for the marriage of their daughter Catherine to Henry V, and then made their new son-in-law the regent of France and heir to the French throne. Henry was to rule France after his father-in-law died, along with a council of French nobles, all from the Burgundian party. He had won big. This is the ultimate victory for the English king. This was Edward III's wildest dreams come true. King Henry and Princess Catherine were married in June 1420 in Troyes Cathedral, and that November they entered Paris amid genuine rejoicing from the citizens of that city. The three estates were summoned and confirmed the Treaty of Troyes and pronounced the assassins of Duke John of Burgundy to be traitors. Henry and his bride spent a festive Christmas holiday in Paris before making their way to Calais, being welcomed by all the towns on the route. And then they sailed to Dover and then travelled to London, where Catherine was crowned queen to glorious celebrations. It seemed that Henry had miraculously achieved both the French crown and a lasting peace. But actually, the larger prize of the crown of France actually screwed him over. Instead of the eminently possible to maintain aim of securing a huge section of France for England, getting it signed off and then sitting back and defending it as the other sides duke it out for who controlled the rest, Henry now focused on taking and holding all of France. And in many ways, this was a much tougher ask. To achieve this new goal, he had to do two things. First, the English had to retain the support of Burgundy. Second, they now had to continue to capture the fortified towns and castles that brought with them dominion over the surrounding countryside, and one after another tipped the balance of resources so far that the Armagnac leaders would have to submit to Henry's authority and the war would finally end. From 1415 to 1419, English armies had made fairly rapid progress towards the latter goal, despite having to keep a wary eye out for the Bungarians. The crushing English victory at Agincourt had left the Dukes of Orleans and Bourbon prisoner in England, Brittany intimidated into English-leaning neutrality, and a whole generation of Frenchmen-at-arms worse and decimated. But with the new circumstances, the complete military defeat of the Dauphin's party was not an unrealistic goal, even if the English and Burgundians cooperated only in the loosest fashion to begin with. Meanwhile, on the other side of the equation, it was practically impossible for the Armagnacs to win the war outright so long as the alliance between Burgundy and England held. Their single priority was to somehow hold off the Anglo-Burgundian conquest and buy time, hoping to rescue their cause by a misstep on the other side, like Burgundy and England falling out, or a civil war in England. And don't forget, that wasn't beyond the realms of speculation. Henry V was the son of a usurper, after all, and it was recognised that the French would do whatever they could to lure Philip the Good to reconcile with the Dauphin, or at least minimise his support for the English. Once the three-way game was rolling, and the English had in effect committed to pursuing the rule of all of France rather than just part of it, the three players needed a partner to succeed, but only two pairings were possible, since the ambitions of the Dauphin and Henry V were polar opposites and they'd never agree. So it would either be Charles and Philip against Henry, or Philip and Henry against Charles. In other words, both Henry and Charles had only one choice of partner, but Philip had two, and therefore he held all the cards. If it were possible to quantify the strength of the Anglo-Burgundy alliance, to graph it over time, one peak of cohesion would be in late 1421 or early 1422. In December 1421, the future Henry VI was born. This seemed practically to ensure a long-term set of close dynastic ties between the Lancastrian monarchy and the House of Burgundy. So this made Philip, already the brother-in-law of the current King and Queen of England, also uncle by marriage of the heir apparent. And thus the expected future King of England and France would be the first cousin to any children born of Philip and his wife, Queen Catherine's sister. Moreover, Henry V and Duke Philip, working together, had recently advanced a whole series of steps towards the ultimate defeat of the Dauphin. The Treaty of Troyes, the occupation of Paris, and the creation of an effective Anglo-Bungarian government base there, and then the elimination of most of the Dauphin's strongholds in northern France. Henry seemed invincible in battle or in siege, and he was feared by all and loved by many. It seemed clear that by supporting him, Philip was backing the winning horse. However, soon after the coronation celebrations, news arrived that reminded all that Henry V holding the crown was not a certain thing. The Dauphin had made an alliance with their old allies in Scotland, and the Scots had sent thousands of troops to support the Armagnac cause. Henry left his brother, the Duke of Clarence, as commander of his forces in Normandy, and the Duke of Clarence had attacked what he thought was a small combined Scottish Armagnac army. It turned out the enemy army was far larger than expected, and the English lost 1,200 men, including the Duke of Clarence. The defeat was not a serious one militarily, but it was a significant morale boost for the Dauphin, and the Armagnacs showed that the English troops were not invincible. This relatively minor engagement, in which Scots and French combined had lost less than 1,000 dead, actually began the unwinding of Henry's great achievements. Various French aristocrats in Picardy began harassing the English, both on land and at sea, causing some disruption to merchant ships bound for Calais, and in Paris there were anti-English riots which had to be put down by the Duke of Exeter. Henry responded to this by gathering 4,000 men-at-arms and 24,000 archers, and landing with them at Calais in June 1421. He made for Paris, where he called on the king, his father-in-law, and after which he rejoined his army to march to Chartres, which was being besieged by the Dauphin. The Dauphin saw this and ran away, and then retreated further as Henry followed him. By then, basically the whole of northern France was in the hands of the English or their Burgundian allies. Henry spent the remainder of the year besieging the city of Menoux on the Maine, which did not surrender until that May. Queen Catherine, meantime, travelled to join him, having recently given birth to their son at Windsor, and the royal couple spent Whitsuntide in Paris. While relaxing in Paris, messengers arrived from the Duke of Burgundy requesting Henry's urgent assistance to relieve Cossigny, which had been attacked by 20,000 Armagnac and Scottish troops. Henry led his army to save Cossigny, at which the Dauphin's force abandoned the siege and ran away. But Henry was struck down by illness during that journey at the castle of Vincennes. The cause of the illness we do not know for sure. It might have been dysentery, or, in my opinion, probably heat stroke from riding all day at midsummer in full armour. We don't know what it was, but we do know it was fatal. Before he died, he appointed his brother, the Duke of Gloucester, the Protector of England, and his other brother, the Duke of Bedford, as the Regent of France. And also on the Regency Council was Henry Beaufort, the Bishop of Winchester, and a son of John of Gaunt and a former Chancellor. These three men would spend the next 25 years competing for power in England. And so, Henry V died in August 1422, at the age of just 36, his great work nearly, but not totally completed. And the new King of England, an heir to the French throne, was now Henry VI, a 9-month-old baby. And 2 months after the death of Henry V, his mentally imbalanced father-in-law, Charles VI, also died, and this meant that the now 11-month-old baby, Henry, was officially King of England and France. And just as France had been stricken by an incapacitated king and the clashing ambitions of his blood relations, now it was a turn of England. And with his death, the alliance between England and Burgundy basically hit a crisis. And it wasn't just those two deaths. Philip the Good's wife, Michelle, also died. And she was the daughter of Charles VI. This trio of deaths almost entirely dissolved the structure of all these family ties, binding together the royal dynasty of Lancaster and the House of Burgundy. In a matter of months, Philip, Duke of Burgundy, went from being the son-in-law of the Lancasterian-controlled King Charles VI, the brother-in-law of the king's regent and heir to the crown, a.k.a. Henry V, and the uncle by marriage of the expected future king, Henry VI, to now being nothing more than an uncle by previous marriage of an infant king with no particular connection to the regent or heir apparent, the Duke of Bedford. All of this kind of made the Burgundians wonder if they'd joined the winning side after all. And with the loss of Henry's firm hand, unfortunately, this unleashed his younger brother, Humphrey of Gloucester, who He personally almost wrecked the alliance. Humphrey soon married Jacqueline of Bavaria and moved to occupy her inheritance of Hainault, the county that put Gloucester and the English directly at odds with the policy of Duke Philip, who expected to inherit that province himself. Under these circumstances, there was a small chance, despite his personal hatred of the Dauphin, that Philip might switch sides. I mean, it probably wasn't going to happen, but even if he didn't, it'd be more likely that he'd kind of pull back, allow the English and Armagnacs fight it out and just focus on controlling the Low Counties. And this was a serious possibility. In fact, it seemed to think that he would. When the Duke of Bedford offered him a leading position in the Parisian court, which probably included an offer to make him the regent of France, Duke Philip declined. He then declined an offer to join the Knights of the Garter, saying he could not take the oath which forbade members from fighting each other. And he was probably eyeballing Humphrey of Gloucester at this point. And by December, he was already starting negotiations with the court of the Dauphin, including seeking a partial truce. This was bad. Luckily, the Duke of Bedford was aware of the risk and acted accordingly. Fully aware of the importance of the Bungarian alliance, Bedford immediately set about doing all he could to strengthen it. He faced several significant problems, which needed both military and dynastic solutions. The first was the restoration of the family ties between his family and the family of Burgundy. Now, the simple way to do that was, let's arrange a new royal wedding. But here, Bedford faced a difficulty that would continue to plague English diplomacy for the rest of this war. A distinct shortage of marriageable men and women close enough to the royal family to serve as a decent trophy husband or wife. In 1423, King Henry VI had no siblings, no offspring, no nieces or nephews, and not even a single first cousin. In fact, there were only two close, dynastically relevant unmarried relatives, his widowed mother and his uncle, the Duke of Bedford. This is actually a devastating political situation. An only child king is a crisis. Compare this to 1337 when the war began. Edward III's unmarried close relatives included his mother, his eldest son and heir, another son, two daughters, two blood nephews, 12 other nephews and nieces, a sister-in-law, and 9 first cousins of Plantagenet descent, for a total of 29. And in 1420, just before the Treaty of Troyes, Henry V's unmarried close relatives included 3 brothers, a half-uncle, and 19 Lancastrian first cousins. 14 of them were English, for a total of 23. And here's Henry VI, less than a year old, and he has his uncle and his mum. Since Bedford could not realistically offer the hand of marriage of Henry VI, because, you know, he's a baby, and he could not remarry the Queen Mother, Bedford had only one dynastic card to play, himself. But it was a powerful card. He was a man in his prime. He was the regent of English-controlled France, and he was one of the great territorial magnates of Europe. And he was also the heir to the crown of England and France. And he actually may have been the single most desirable bachelor in Christendom at the time. Since Henry VI was an infant and many children died before producing heirs, there was more than a small chance that Bedford, and ultimately his son, would become king of England and France. And even if that didn't happen, Bedford in his own right not only held extensive lands in England, he could be expected to carve out a substantial amount of lands in France as well. And indeed, he did do this from 1424, where he took the titles of Duke of Anjou. So in order to restore the family linkage between him and the Burgundians, Bedford made the strongest possible gesture by marrying Duke Philip's sister Anne. This turned Bedford and Duke Philip into brothers-in-law and made Anne, who was dear to Philip and became so to Bedford, a prominent force for harmony between them. I mean, this is a hell of a marriage coup. And Bedford wasn't even done yet. He had another card to play. He improved England's chances of winning by turning another enemy into an ally. The Duke of Brittany agreed to switch sides and join Burgundy and England in a triple alliance, again signified by a wedding. This time, Bedford helping to arrange the marriage of Duke Philip's only other unmarried sister, Margaret, to the Breton Duke's brother, Arthur. But while he was doing this, the Duke of Bedford was also responding militarily. In the aftermath of Henry V's death, the Dauphin's captains had undertaken several minor operations in the hopes of benefiting from English disarray. But in most cases, the gains they made were quickly undone by Anglo-Burgundian responses. Most significantly, the French captured the strategic bridge town of Moulins on the Seine between Rouen and Paris. Bedford, with some Bungarians as well as English and Anglo-French troops, went in person to take it back. And he conducted the siege so freaking brilliantly that not only did he retake it, he compelled the French lords inside to surrender other fortresses they had held as part of their capitulation. As a result, after this and going into spring and summer following, English and Burgundian detachments also captured several other major locations around the place. And this caused the Dauphin's forces to focus on one big military effort, an attempt to capture Cravant. The town was an important strategic location, and made more important because a group of prominent Burgundian captains had hastily taken the town in order to cast out a French force, and capturing these Burgundian nobles along with the town would mean that the Dauphin's forces would, quote, give the Burgundians so much to do that they will not know on which foot to dance, unquote. Because Cravant was badly provisioned, it had to be rescued rapidly. But the French had sent a full-scale army against it at a time when English and Burgundians had many troops occupied in other operations. In this emergency, the Duke of Bedford managed to collect about 2,500 troops to join a Burgundian force of similar size, and they managed to crush a much larger Franco-Scottish armies at the Battle of Cravant. This defeat saw the Dauphin lose about 5,000 men, including both of the army's commanders. It was a huge setback for him. It practically ended the threat to Philip's southern domains and provided Philip with a potent reminder of the military value of English troops. And after the battle, English and Burgundian soldiers worked together to clear several more Dauphinist strongholds from the borders of Philip's territory. One writer for the Burgundian side commented that there had never been so much brotherly affection between the English and Burgundians since they fought and won at the Battle of Cravant. England and Burgundy. The alliance held. England was still in the game, and this war carried on. By 1422, it had raged for 90 years, and it seemed like it would continue for the foreseeable. But right now around us were a series of circumstances that were to have incredible impacts upon London's story going forward. A small, limited royal family, the widowed Queen Catherine of France, the endless need for resources to maintain this war, the importance of Calais as a commercial centre, the rivalries of the Regency Council of Henry VI. All these things are to play an increasingly crucial role in the tale of the city that is to come. Henry V had been a popular, inspirational, brilliant leader, and he'd achieved great things in his short life. He had also left England in a staggering amount of debt when he died. He had nearly succeeded at uniting England with France, but that would only have been possible if there had been no remaining French claimants to the French throne. The Dauphin Charles still had supporters in the south of the nation and would have to be removed if the promised union was to become a reality. On paper, while his death seemed like a setback, this war was to carry on. And this then is the situation in 1422. And with that done, next episode we'll leave affairs in France and return back to London. And London was, about to enter a situation that by now I think we can all agree the city hated. A boy as king and powerful men seeking power around him. Every time that had happened in the past, it had been bad for London. Instability threatened, and the people of our city would have braced themselves. Because bottom line, there was a storm coming. Okay, that's it from me. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week for the 153rd episode of The Story of London. This is Saul, hoping you had a good week, and I'll see you next week. Bye.